Good morning. Before we turn to our first case, we shall take a moment to mark the passing of Kevin J. Barry on Friday after a long and courageous bout with cancer. Kevin had a notable career in the Coast Guard, including distinguished service as an appellate judge. Following his retirement from the Coast Guard, he was a prolific writer on the subject of military justice and a major force in military law activities of the bar. In recent years, Kevin continued to participate with vigor despite his illness. Just last month, we had the opportunity to hear him speak at our annual conference, where he presented the annual writing award that bears his name. We express our deepest sympathies to his devoted wife, Rosalyn, and members of the family. We'll now observe a brief moment of silence in his memory. Thank you. We'll now call our first case, United States against Nance, counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. U.S. v. Negron, this court stated that it has repeatedly advised and cautioned judges regarding the use of conclusions and leading questions that merely extract from an accused yes or no responses during a providency inquiry. Appellant's plea to wrongfully using cough and cold medicine was not provident because, unlike Erickson, Appellant's plea does not reflect, in his own words, an understanding that he engaged in harmful conduct that would undermine his capability and readiness to perform military duties, and, as in the ground, a significant number of his responses were the result of leading questions. Although Appellant did admit, in his own words, that he became mentally impaired, overly drunk is how he described it on one occasion, this is not enough under Erickson. In Erickson, the accused said, in his own words, that he belonged to the Air Force and that inhaling nitrous oxide damages brain cells. It's bad for you. Being a part of the Air Force, I know that I'm supposed to be on my toes. In other words, he himself provided facts that were not merely yes or no responses to leading questions, but he understood that his impairment was harmful and that it would undermine his capability and readiness to perform his military duties.
Didn't the accused in this case admit to using it with other service members?
He did, Your Honor.
Isn't that a direct effect? Doesn't that have a direct and palpable effect on good order and discipline?
He didn't say that in his own words, Your Honor.
But didn't he admit that he used it with two other junior airmen, both during the providency inquiry and in the stipulation of fact?
That would be correct, Your Honor.
And isn't that an objective fact from which the military judge can find that it was prejudicial to the good order and discipline of the military service?
The military, it wasn't in his own words, Your Honor. He did admit.
Or the facts that I just said in his own words.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what didn't he admit in his own words?
How it was harmful and how it would undermine his capability and readiness to perform military duties.
Did he acknowledge that in response to the questions from the military judge?
He did, Your Honor.
And is it the rule of this court that yes or no answers, amen type answers, are an absolute prohibition, or are they a factor to be taken into account in assessing the providency of the plea?
A factor, Your Honor. This court has never said that thou shalt never use a leading question.
What about the effect of the stipulation of fact?
I'd say there was very little in the stipulation of fact worth considering.
So you don't think that the fact that he stipulated to the use with the junior airman and that he said that he passed out or went into a dreamlike state from which he emerged disoriented, et cetera, with respect to the use of the CCA or CCC?
No, Your Honor.
You don't think those are useful facts?
They're facts, Your Honor, but not enough to sustain the policy of the plea. The stipulation of fact never says that it's harmful. And the fact that he used it with junior airmen, that would be maybe appropriate for the military judge to say, I see that you use it with junior airmen. Please explain to me why that's conduct prejudicial to the order of discipline in this case. That was not done.
Does he have to admit to facts that constitute actions that are prejudicial to good order and discipline? Or does he have to admit that his conduct is prejudicial to good order and discipline with an explanation as to why? in order to for the, us to find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in accepting the plea?
Well, in determining whether there's a substantial basis in law or fact, and based on the number of leading questions in this case, I would say the latter, Your Honor. It was all the more important for him to state in his own words how it would have been counted to the prejudice of good order and discipline, notwithstanding the fact that the military judge did supply facts in his leading questions.
Well, what about the facts in the stipulation of fact? What about the facts during the providency inquiry when he described what had happened?
Well, the facts in the stipulation of fact really state that I felt nauseous, I saw different lights. That's not how he's saying that.
I passed out or went into a dreamlike state from which he emerged disoriented.
I wouldn't say that's necessarily harmful, Your Honor, any more than taking a couple extra shots of scotch is harmful. I mean, he likened it to being overly drunk or intoxicated. I'm not saying that can never be conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline. I'm just saying that under these facts, it's all the more important that he state why it's harmful in his own words without the use of leading questions. And this court in DeGran, although not stating an absolute bar to the use of leading questions, was rather pointed in its admonition to military judges that when you do this, we're going to be scrutinizing the plea.
Well, what about the fact that after describing, do you agree, first of all, that facts admitted to in a stipulation of fact may be used to support the proper inquiry?
Correct, Your Honor. This Court has said that they can consider the record.
Well, and doesn't RCM 811 say the same thing? I mean, doesn't it basically say that stipulations, if they're accepted, are taken as true even if they're otherwise contradicted?
Correct me if I'm wrong. I believe RCM 811 is the stipulation of expected testimony, or does that cover both?
The parties may make an oral or written stipulation to any fact, the contents of which a document or the expected testimony of a witness in this stipulation of fact was entered into pursuant to RCM 811.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and after describing the use of this medicine with the airmen, including the airmen that are junior to him, and after describing the effects of the medicine upon himself, including the fact that it made him pass out or go into a dream state, et cetera, he said his use of CCC was, under the circumstances, to the prejudice of good order and discipline. Why isn't that enough, even if everything else wasn't?
Well, that's still, that's the very epitome of a legal conclusion. The fact that he said...
He doesn't have to... Acknowledging a legal conclusion isn't required to sustain a providence inquiry. Objective facts that support the legal conclusion is necessary.
Correct, Your Honor. Facts that are elicited from the accused himself, as opposed to, as the court said in Iran, parroting responses back and forth with the military judge.
So is the bottom line to your argument that the fact that he uses medicine with junior airmen and the fact that it made him pass out and went into a dream state, et cetera, that those facts aren't sufficient to constitute conduct that's prejudicial to good order and discipline?
Correct, Your Honor. And if the
so
judge,
that's your argument?
Partially, Your Honor. The military judge could have said, I see that you use it with junior airmen. Please explain to me why that's conduct prejudicial to good order and discipline in this case. That was not done. And the fact that he went to a dreamlike state, that's different than what the court said in Erickson, because in Erickson, the court specifically relied on the fact that he said it was harmful in his own words.
Counsel, is your argument...
Excuse me, is that your argument?
No. Not yet.
Is your argument that the facts admitted to in the stipulation are insufficient as a matter of law to find the accused guilty of the offense, or is it that those facts need to be amplified in the verbal exchange with the military judge in order to establish the providence of the inquiry, or both?
I will say the latter, Your Honor.
The latter being both, or the second one?
The second one, Your Honor. I'm not saying that the facts are totally relevant in the stipulation of fact. It's just that it was incumbent upon the military judge in the Iran to develop those facts so that we see it in the accused's own words. It's of course noted that when we're dealing with a guilty plea case, we're not dealing with a contested case, and those facts are not tested in the crucible of the adversarial process. So it's important for the judge to ensure, under 45 and Karen's progeny, that the accused understands that it's, in his own words, that his conduct is criminal.
Was there anything in the Providence inquiry that was, since you brought up Article 45, was there anything in the Providence inquiry that brought up a matter inconsistent with his plea?
There is one part of his plea, Your Honor, where he starts talking about illegal drug use. I don't know if that's inconsistent. I think it's a little bit confusing. He starts saying how anytime you use illegal drugs, I don't know if he was referring back to the ecstasy use or if he was going to be mistaken impression that his use of coracine was illegal in this case.
Well, he admitted that it was illegal in this case.
Well, I'm sorry, that it was a violation of another law. Like in Erickson, this court said in his opinion, we also take judicial notice of the fact that inhaling nitrous oxide is illegal in Texas, et cetera. So there was nothing like that in that case. And I'm not saying that per se an example of something inconsistent with this plea, but I think it's evidence of something.
Was there anything in the Providence inquiry that suggested that the appellant lacked any understanding with respect to the meaning and effect of his guilty plea?
Not for Clause 1. Clause 1, our argument is that he did not provide sufficient facts to support the plea. I think it was knowing and voluntary.
Well, I understand that's your argument today, but with respect to the Providence inquiry, was there anything in the Providence inquiry that makes us wonder whether he understood the effect of the plea that he was making, meaning that he understood that by pleading guilty, he was waiving his right to make the government prove all the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt?
No.
The military judge gave both counsel, an opportunity to revisit the record, right?
Yes.
In an unusual manner, and arguably that cuts both ways. First, it suggests perhaps that the judge wasn't confident he had enough on the record. But secondly, certainly defense counsel had the opportunity to say you don't have enough on the record. What weight, if any, should we give to that in assessing whether there's a substantial basis in law or fact to turn the reverse this plea?
And is Your Honor referring to the concept that in a close case, the military judge can rely on the defense evaluation of the case?
Well, I'm taking the fact from this plea that the judge thought about it and came back and specifically asked, is there anything more I should be doing here?
I'd say that was a good
thing. Which is not standard care procedure, the return visit.
Right.
So your job is to tell me which way I should spin that and why.
Well, when he came back, the military judge said essentially that he thought Clause 1 was an LIO of Clause 2, which in essence kind of got it backwards, because the issue is if the plea is provident as to Clause 1, the potential issue is Clause 2 or LIO of Clause 1, not... So maybe that the military judge came back on the record and said what he said might show that he might have been influenced by an erroneous view of the law.
Okay, I'm on page 43 or 46, depending on how you count. Does either side feel further inquiry on this specification is required? Defense counsel, not from the defense. So does that help or hurt you? And why?
And anyway, I'm sorry, was that page 43 of the record, or was that
43 of the record and 46 of the whatever the other thing is?
I don't think it hurts the case, our position, Your Honor. I think it shows that he wasn't really sure whether it was Clause 1 or not, or Clause 2. I don't think it hurts our position.
Do you admit? Do you agree that the appellant admitted that the conduct was service discrediting under Clause 2, leaving aside the fact that's not what was charged?
I don't, Your Honor.
He didn't even admit that.
I don't, and here's why. He did say, in his own words, about he used the term bad image, which one would say is kind of classic Clause 2, providing classic Clause 2 type facts, but the problem is, when he made that statement, the military judge hadn't defined what Clause 2 was. So I think it would be inappropriate, or the defense position is that it would be inappropriate to uphold the plea based on what he said for Clause 2 when the military judge hadn't defined what it was.
Let me go back to a question related to what Judge Baker asked you. When the military judge said, does either side feel further inquiry on the specification is required, whether that question reflected a fairly standard inquiry at the end of a competency inquiry or whether it reflected the military judge's belief that this was a close case. Okay, that's the beginning of my question. I'm not done. What do we do with that in light of this court's case law on what you do with respect to the military judge's discretion in a closed case when the defense counsel has been asked and answers no further questions are required?
I would say it would be the former, Your Honor. The military judge was doing what most military judges do at a guilty plea inquiry, is any further inquiry. When he asked the question of the defense counsel, the defense counsel said, no problems, Your Honor. I don't believe this court should attach any significant weight to that, even though there is case law that says in a closed case, the military judge can kind of rely on the defense evaluation of the evidence. In this case, that's not an evaluation. It's just the defense counsel saying, no, Your Honor. I mean,
you don't think that the defense counsel was weighing in on his view of the providence inquiry and whether it was sufficient when he said that he didn't think additional questions were required? I mean, on that day, the defense counsel wanted the providence inquiry to be accepted, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It's probably in every case the defense counsel wants the providence plea to be sufficient, which is why this court should, although the military judge may attach some weight to that, this court should not attach too much weight to it in light of the, every defense counsel wants to get through a plea. I don't consider what the defense counsel said to be much of an evaluation. He made a statement, and then he asked a question. To the extent that this is a close case, I don't believe the defense counsel's evaluation tips in favor of the government. He appeared to initially have difficulty understanding, let alone articulating in his own words how his conduct was prejudicial to the order and discipline, because when the military judge originally asked him, is it clause one, he said no. And then the military judge repeated the definition a second time and asked the question again. And at that time he said yes, Your Honor. And the military judge said, please explain how. And then the appellant gave a response that was not responsive. After that, the military judge led him down a series of leading questions. As to LeBron, the providency inquiry is fatally deficient because this is a classic example of leading questions that extract little relevant factual information from the appellant himself. Although the military judge did supply facts in the majority of the questions, and there's little benefit in establishing a factual record, and this is from the court LeBron, we find little benefit in establishing a factual record, whereas here, appellant is merely parroting responses to leading questions asked by the military judge. So the fact that facts were provided does not save the plea in this case. And if there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. You have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I am Captain Michael Rakowski, along with Major Jeremy Weber, who represent the United States. The military judge did not abuse his discretion when he accepted appellant's guilty plea as provident because there is a factually sufficient basis in the record in order to support that finding. Additionally, the military judge relied on relevant case law and considered the defense counsel's evaluation of the evidence prior to accepting the plea. In this case, between the care inquiry, the stipulation of fact, and the stipulation of expected testimony, there was more than enough factual evidence to support the plea in accordance with RCM 910E. The government would like to briefly go over six facts we believe establish the prejudicial nature of appellant's conduct. The first...
Counsel, my colleagues may have a different view, but it does not appear that the legal sufficiency is at issue in the case. The issue is the adequacy of the providency inquiry, and one of the sub-issues is whether the parroting responses constituted error or whether in the context of the whole case they don't destroy the providence of the inquiry. So could you address it from that,
yes,
that point of view?
Turning towards Negron and Jordan as cited by the appellant, The government would argue that the questions asked by the military judge in this case, in the Karen inquiry, was different from the cases in Nagorno-Jordan. In both Nagorno-Jordan, the military judge never asked the appellant to explain why his conduct was prejudicial. In this case, the judge did. Additionally, in both Nagorno-Jordan, the military judge really just stated legal conclusions. He asked the appellant, was your conduct prejudicial? And the appellant said yes, and that was the end of it. In this case, the military judge went further. He made questions based on the facts the appellant had already provided to the court and asked him if the facts he previously provided meant his conduct was prejudicial or not.
Counsel, prior to the military judge asking the questions, do you believe that providency had been established?
We do, Your Honor.
And point out where you come up with that conclusion.
Your Honor, based on the stipulation of fact that it already been in the record,
And where in the stipulation of fact? What are you relying on?
Your Honor, some of the facts that have already been cited by this court, the fact that he was using with several different Air Force members, one of which was junior in rank to him, the fact that it was occurring on base on multiple occasions, most notably his intent. This is not the case where someone simply uses one or two extra pills. This is someone that's using 12 to 16 times the amount for medical dosage, and his intention in doing so was to get high.
So in your view, all that is needed is the underlying facts, not why those facts would make it prejudicial.
Your Honor, under the clear language of Article 134, it states that under the facts and circumstances determines whether conduct is prejudicial. We would argue that in this case, the facts were met. Certainly it is helpful when an accused can also articulate why those facts serve as prejudicial. And in this case, the military judge
So in a providency inquiry, an appellant or a defendant need not explain why facts he has admitted constitute the offense in his mind.
Your Honor, as long as the appellant recognizes that his conduct was wrongful and in violation of law, and he admits facts and circumstances that satisfy the providency of the plea, would we feel that is sufficient?
And where in the stipulation of expected testimony, how does that enter into the appellant's understanding of what constitutes the crime?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the stipulation of expected testimony lays out that the important facts that this is a substance that, when abused, you can actually get high off of. This is not something like someone eating too much sugar or something to that effect. This is actually a dangerous substance, and it also includes...
You don't have children, do you?
I do, Your Honor. I have a 2-year-old, so I do understand.
You might want to reconsider that statement, but go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. But this is much more dangerous than what I was trying to get at, Your Honor. Specifically, in the stipulation of expected testimony, a licensed pharmacist agreed that wrongful use of this substance in this manner could possibly lead to death.
Isn't that true of alcohol as well?
Your Honor, it may be true of alcohol as well.
So are you arguing to Judge Erdman that this case is, the appellant would like this court to view this case as a getting drunk in the barracks case? Why is it or is it not a getting drunk in the barracks case?
Your Honor, in regards to that, we would talk about first the Erickson case that this court decided 4 years ago. This is essentially the same case as Erickson. In that case, he used nitrous oxide. In this case, they used chloroceutin.
Well, I want you to address it in the framework of Judge Erdman's question, which is, you, if I understand you correctly, the government's position is that it's not necessary for an accused to indicate on the record in his own words why something is prejudicial to good order or discipline or service discrediting. It's merely sufficient to put facts on the record from which others can draw that conclusion.
Yes.
Is that a fair characterization of your position?
That's a fair characterization of part of our argument. Obviously, we think in this case he actually did admit why he felt his conduct was prejudicial and service discrediting. But in reference to alcohol, Your Honor, certainly alcohol is a unique substance in the law, and that is the only substance whose lawful purpose is intoxication. It has been given a unique status in society by Congress in the 21st Amendment, and it actually has a unique status under the UCMJ, in that there's several different violations of the UCMJ that, based on facts and circumstances, one could commit with alcohol. In this case, the lawful purpose of chloroceutin is medication. And in this case, the appellant did not use it for its lawful purpose. He intentionally overdosed in it for an unlawful purpose, and that's one of the facts and circumstances that needs to be considered to determine whether his conduct was prejudicial or not.
Is Clause 1 and LIO a Clause 2, or vice versa?
Yes, Your Honor. And that would be referring to the Rogers opinion that the military judge cited in the Care inquiry.
How's Medina cut into that?
Yes, Your Honor. In Rogers, the Air Force Court, relying on an earlier Foster opinion of this court, stated that Clause 1 is a lesser-included offense of Clause 1.
Right, but answer the question.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm getting to that. This court in Medina, we believe that Rogers can be reconciled with Medina, and even if Medina does supersede Rogers, that the facts of this case meet the requirements of Medina. Essentially, Medina stated in the simplest form that under an appellant needs to know under which clause he is pleading guilty under Article 134. And that can be accomplished either through advice by the military judge or through operation of lesser-included offense doctrine. Here, Medina had not been decided at the time the military judge had to make this discretionary decision. So at that point, Rogers was relevant.
Let's take Medina out of it. Let's say the judge Rogers is incorrect for sake of argument. It doesn't matter whether Medina exists yet. We're reviewing this for whether there's a substantial basis in law or fact to reverse. The heck with Medina. What if the judge got it wrong and that one and two, I don't even remember what he said, but one was an LIO of the other, whatever. And how can we be confident that that wasn't the basis on which he decided the plea was provident?
Your Honor, I would look at the actual record in this case.
Do you understand what I'm asking? If he's wrong on that, how do we know that that isn't the essence of why he accepted the plea?
Your Honor, essentially, if Medina wasn't around, in order to find abuse of discretion, we'd have to find that the judge had an erroneous view of the law. If he was relying on the Rogers opinion...
And we're stipulating that he did.
Yes, Your Honor.
For the purpose of the question.
Yes, Your Honor. Then the government's argument would be that it would not be an erroneous view of the law. Nothing had been overruled on the Rogers or superseded at that point.
Well, but in Judge Baker's question, disregard Medina? We're not talking about Medina.
Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming arguendo that Rogers was incorrect.
Assuming arguendo that Rogers was incorrect, we feel that the factual basis argument that we made previously would address this. The military judge specifically said on the record he felt that he met factually the basis for Clause 1, and he also met factually the basis for Clause 2.
But when you,
Rogers issue.
Counsel, when you look at the record here, and when you look at the comments made by the military judge, doesn't that lead you to a different conclusion? Because when they came back from their break, basically what he said is that, well, I think this obviously is service discrediting. And then he said, and under Rogers, basically, I think there's enough here. I don't know exactly what his words were, but it seems to me that he was relying pretty heavily on Rogers at that point.
Your Honor, I would disagree. Turning to page 50 of the joint appendix, essentially what the military judge does on page 49 and 50 is he first states why he believes this met the service discrediting clause 2 requirements, and the appellant agrees with him that his conduct was service discrediting. Then he goes through the reasons why he feels that his conduct was prejudicial to our discipline, and only after going through those reasons does he also touch on Rogers. So we would argue that the earlier statements of the prejudicial right there states that the military judge found a separate reason for finding prejudicial and that Rogers was just further authority he was relying on.
In terms of findings, what finding did the military judge make with respect to the offense that the accused pled to?
The military judge found him guilty of Clause 1, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Additionally, the military judge properly considered the defense counsel's evaluation of the evidence before he accepted the plea as provident. Appellant's counsel has stated that merely saying no further questions isn't really a position of the defense counsel, but we'd ask you to then turn to the very next page where the military judge is instructing the appellant that he should take a few minutes to discuss this with his defense counsel. The defense counsel affirmatively argues on the record that the appellant met all requirements of the prejudicial and good order and discipline aspect of the offense. That is not only a no further questions response, that is an affirmative argument that everything has been met in the military judge and you go no further to find this plea offense.
As the defense counsel today indicated, were suggested, how much do we give any weight to what the defense counsel says in a situation like that, other than considering it for the overall context of whether something was or was not sufficient? That is, this is not given any weight in terms of a waiver, is it?
No, it's not, Your Honor. This court has been clear in its previous decisions in Clark, Harrell, and McCrimmon that the military judge is allowed to give weight to the evaluation of the evidence by the defense counsel, not that he's allowed to abandon his requirements to...
Ultimately, it's his or her responsibility as the judge.
It is,
that
Your
situation.
Honor.
In terms of the yes or no answer questions or the amen questions or however we want to call it, What principle do we apply in determining when a judge can permissibly use leading questions to clarify a providence inquiry, and at what point does it become an impermissible substitute of the judge's thought process for that of the accused?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of any hard and fast principle in the law.
Is there anything the government would suggest here?
The government would suggest that in a case where the appellant has already stated in his own words all the facts sufficient in order to establish a basis under RCM 910E, that the leading questions alone do not undo an otherwise provident guilty plea. Certainly, it's advisable for a military judge not to use leading questions, but we do feel in this case that the questions asked by the military judge were different than the ones asked in Jordan and Negron, and that he was essentially asking the questions based on the facts the appellant had already provided to him.
What's the government's view as to the status of the Rogers case today?
Your Honor, and that would be interesting guidance from this court as to how Rogers stands under Medina. We'd certainly invite any guidance from this court on that matter. We feel that Rogers is still a good case law, but essentially, if this court sees otherwise, we feel that under the advice by the military judge in this case, he still met the requirements of Medina.
But you think Rogers is still good regardless?
Well, Your Honor, it's hard to say in light of Medina, because Medina doesn't specifically say Clause 1 is not a lesser included offense of Clause 2. Medina was about Clause 3, and it simply requires an appellant know under which clause he's pleading guilty. So it's a little... it's unclear, I guess, if the status is. As far as the defense counsel's evaluation of the evidence, the government would just point out that in those opinions cited in our brief, Clark, Harrell, and McCrimmon, those are all cases in which an appellant came before this court and argued that his plea was not provident, when his defense counsel argued affirmatively to the opposite, or at least argued that no further questions were asked. But specifically in Clark, in that case, the military judge was concerned about an entrapment defense. He asked the defense counsel whether an entrapment defense applied, and the defense counsel argued affirmatively it did not apply because his client was predisposed to commit the crime. That's essentially the same thing we have here. The military judge was saying there might be an issue with this out there, and the defense counsel affirmatively argued, no, there is not. The military judge, if this is even considered a borderline case, should be given the opportunity to give weight to that evaluation of the evidence under abuse of discretion standard. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Please.
I have one brief question. Let's say, for the sake of argument, the three judges on the court agreed with appellant's point of view. Do you have a view as to how, if at all, the acceptance of the plea with respect to the Kaufmanson use prejudiced appellant in light of his punishment and the other offense to which he pleaded guilty?
Your Honor, I think if this court were to plead guilty, we would have to remand it to the service court. In this case, he did plead guilty to three uses of ecstasy as well. So certainly the sentence he got, which included no confinement, should have certainly been adjudged for the same offense if he had only been found guilty of Clause 1. But I'm not aware of what authority to cite that this court could reassess the sentence without remanding.
Could this court determine there's no prejudice and then not remand on that basis?
You certainly could, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The military judge did not abuse his discretion in accepting the appellant's guilty plea as provident because there is a factual basis in the entire record, including the stipulation of expected testimony, to support the finding that this was factually supported. Additionally, the military judge properly relied on what was at least at that point relevant case law and considered the evaluation of the evidence by the defense counsel before finding the appellant guilty plea was valid. As appellant has failed to demonstrate a substantial basis in law and fact for questioning his plea, this court should affirm the findings and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal? Assuming you prevail on the issue of law, would you address the issue of prejudice in terms of whether there should or should not be a remand?
Yes, Your Honor. There are only two charges in this case, and the trial counsel did specifically rely on the use of chlorocetin twice in the sentencing argument, so we would argue that there is prejudice in this case. So certainly we would argue that the case could either be remanded to the lower court for a sentence reassessment. It is true that charge one was the more serious charge involving ecstasy use, but the fact that the trial counsel specifically and explicitly referred to the contested charge during the sentencing argument, we would argue, and given the number of charges in this case, would be enough to find some prejudice in this case.
Do you have what's your position as to whether the wrongful use of cough medicine can be ever be criminal at all?
It can be, Your Honor. We are not arguing that abusing cough medicine can never be criminal. We're simply arguing that in this case, when you're dealing with a charge like this, it's incumbent upon the military judge, in light of Negron, to ensure that the opponent has elicited in his own words why it's criminal, why it's wrongful, why it's harmful, and how it's going to have an impact on Clause 1 or Clause 2.
What about abusing alcohol or coffee?
I would say the same thing, Your Honor. Would it be possible for an individual to be criminally liable for getting blitzed or stone-cold drunk? Yes, I think it would be possible under certain facts. But it would just be incumbent upon the military judge, again, to ensure that factual information is elicited from the accused himself versus parroting responses back and forth, yes or no answers. The record is lacking in anything that can seriously be called a defense evaluation of the evidence. Defense counsel said, I think he has covered the good order and discipline aspect. It's not charged as a group incident. And then he asked a question. It's the defense position that that's not the kind of evaluation that this court envisions in determining whether the military judge can give weight to that. I think it involves a little bit more back and forth between the military judge and the defense counsel, not just yes, Your Honor, no, Your Honor, or a question here or there. And if there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The court will be in recess until 10:15 this morning. All rise.